The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. On this week's podcast, we're finding out about the gadgets and gizmos that Sony are working on to heighten the three-dimensional experience. I kid you not, like fully, totally interactive 3D, as if you were in the room holding a BFG. It is quite literally the stuff of my nightmares. And here to lead me through the therapy that I'm going to need to face it is The Guardian's games correspondent, Keith Stewart. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Keith. Alex.
How are you, Keith?
I'm good. It's all going to be okay. Don't be scared of 3D.
Well,
it's not going to come and get you.
You have no idea about my nightmares, actually. But you are off to an exciting place this evening, aren't you?
I am. I'm off to the Tokyo Game Show tonight for the first time in 10 years. So I suspect there'll be slightly fewer Dreamcast games this time.
But I also suspect it's going to be just as noisy, just as crazy, and just as full of cosplay as ever.
Absolutely. I'm definitely going to get involved in cosplay. We're taking the film crew, so I think maybe Chun-Li.
you are.
If you want nightmares, just think about that.
Yeah, thanks a lot for that. Jemima Kish is also joining us in the studio. Please bring me back to reality. Have you ever seen anything as terrifying as the idea of Keith in cosplay?
Oh, giving birth, that's pretty terrifying. Like the stuff that comes out of your body when you give birth, yeah, that's pretty gnarly. That's far more gnarly than the BFG. Let's leave it there.
This is absolutely not the direction that I was hoping that the podcast would go in this morning. But speaking of 3D, the cost of 3D printers have plummeted in recent years. Once the stuff of science fiction, they're being used for everything from self-replicating machines to personalized dolls to food. Jemima, would you eat a chocolate bar, given that we have just been eating a lot of dirty chocolate that I brought over from America that was printed?
My first instinct is to say, yes, I'll eat any chocolate. But I am getting more discerning in my old age.
And so, no, you wouldn't eat a chocolate bar that was
printed?
Well,
it depends what ingredients it was made with. Whether, well, you know, if it was chocolate. Hershey's, I probably wouldn't, etc.
Keith, are you ethically opposed to the idea of eating something that was printed?
No, I don't think so. Having grown up with watching Star Trek and seeing them produce any food they want out of nothing and thinking what an awesome technology that is, then I am quite happy. I'll eat anything that's been printed, virtually manufactured.
Printed anyway, is it? Because the printing ink is only made up of the constituent parts of whatever it is you're trying to build. And so if you're printing, in inverted commas, food, it's still going to be made up of chocolate ingredients, which is fine by moi.
Bringing this back to technology, also on this week's podcast, we're discovering the supercomputer that predicts the future by looking at events of the past. Yes, I am skeptical. The latest in the car crash viewing that is the departure of the sacked Yahoo CEO Carol Bartz, the content company's plans to cozy up with US giant AOL, and the future of literature in the week that the inventor of the ebook dies. We're also finding out what mobile phone maker HTC has up its sleeve that it reckons will knock the socks off the competition. Keep listening to the next 30 minutes of Techness from The Guardian. It's only been 2 years since the firebrand Carol Bartz was brought into the sinking ship that was Yahoo. Its shares were plummeting, its popularity was waning, and its portfolio of rather interesting acquisitions were unfortunately disappearing on shelves or being flogged like they were last season's haute couture. But now the captain has been ejected from her cruise liner, and she's not heading for Davy Jones's locker without a fight. In a last-bit attempt to stick it to the bosses, Bartz called the remaining managers doofuses, I quite like that expression, and unceremoniously quit the board. Jemima, is this a wise move?
She actually also said, they fucked me over. And you have to admire Bartz for her chutzpah.
She's never really pulled her punches, has she?
Well, she's not afraid to drop the F-bomb, which in America I think they frown on a little more than we do. And we think, well, that makes her sound like a human being instead of a corporate automaton.
Yet it seems like they didn't want a human being, they wanted a corporate automaton.
Well, I don't know. Yahoo's problems are multiple, I think. Is this a wise move? I think, in balance, no. Because there are only limited things that can be done to Yahoo to try and save the business. And I think the amount of trauma to staff, it's too risky, and they should have let her stay till the end of her contract and try and sort things out. But she had a fairly low approval or support rating among staff, according to one survey that was done when she left by Glassdoor. But still, I think the plans that she'd put in place to try and turn the company round were dependent on going to the end of next year. And what would they really have lost by letting her, you know, go to the end of her contract?
You're throwing the baby out with the bathwater. These plans that could potentially have turned the strategy, that could have turned everything around, it may actually come to fruition in 3 years' time, 2 years' time, and somebody else is going to get the cake.
There was nobody obvious to take over from her. There is nobody obvious to take over from her. There was never one big major change that was really obvious that needed to be done. And what Barts had done was introduce the easiest cost-cutting measures and steps to try and make changes initially, and then later on, hopefully, we would have seen more innovative stuff. And that's what we've lost by her leaving now.
Keith, where does Yahoo sit in the game space? Because certainly, it's got a presence in terms of reviews, but in terms of producing or distributing content?
It used to be, it was one of those things where casual gaming actually 3 or 4 years ago was dominated by companies like Yahoo and AOL that had these big front pages that a lot of casual computer users never changed. Well, when their default browsers came, then they were on AOL or Yahoo. So Yahoo were in a good position to kind of dominate casual gaming. And I think that they had a presence, but they never really kind of moved with where gaming was going. And then you got lots of new flash game sites like Kongregate and Newgrounds that came along and dominated that space. So it was maybe somewhere that they could have evolved to, but I don't think it was ever really part of their major strategy.
Jemima, is that a short-sighted thing? Because we're seeing more and more companies, we're seeing some incredible valuations of social gaming and all of these things. Should Yahoo have become a major player in this space, given that it had, quite a hefty and well-respected platform?
You could say the same for social and search, which are the two big areas that Yahoo has arguably failed to move into. And likewise, Google with social, belatedly seen Google Plus trying to move into that space. But Yahoo is still a profitable advertising company. Despite all the bad press, it's still profitable. And much of the future of that space depends on what happens with Facebook, which is aggressively growing its share of the display advertising market. And I think Facebook is predicted to get to about 19% by 2012, according to one figure. So, and Yahoo's on about 12.5%.
So it is. I mean, it's not lagging too far behind the current major player.
No, it's not. And there were some very interesting stories this week about, and these are very loose reports, but Tim Armstrong, the AOL chief executive, had approached Yahoo and suggested a merger. So sort of two dying dinosaurs tying up together doesn't initially seem that great. He's got some wind in his sails because of the acquisitions of the Huffington Post and TechCrunch, which has had its own traumas this week that we won't go into.
Both of them, in fact, haven't
yes,
they?
Yes,
gosh, it's all, it is really all change and mutiny in the ranks, isn't
well, you,
it?
You think that, why would AOL want to be associated, well, perhaps you'd think this, with Yahoo because it's had a lot of bad press, but actually AOL is in a far worse shape and much smaller than Yahoo. The market cap of Yahoo at the moment is $18 billion and AOL is only $1.6 billion and is also not profitable compared to Yahoo. So actually, what really would be in it for Yahoo? They've had these discussions before and nothing's come of it, and I suspect that's why.
Keith, what else do you think could help Yahoo along here? I mean, do you think that it should? It had quite a few interesting acquisitions for a while, but as I mentioned, it seems to have sold them off. For example, Delicious has now gone over to the more interesting the YouTube founder, so they may be playing around with that. I mean, what types of things do you think, looking into your crystal ball?
They've got to get into as Jemima was saying, they've got to get into the social space more and come up with something there. But I think they're one of those old timers, one of those really old companies from the beginning of the internet days who don't seem to have been able to catch up, and they don't seem to have been able to attract like amazing minds to work on kind of blue sky stuff. So I think, yeah, somewhere in social and social gaming would make a lot of sense.
I'll back up your Flickr photos now is all I can say.
Hell yeah.
More on the meltdown as the Yahoo Phoenix rises from the ashes on guardian.co.uk/technology. Other departures sadly hit the headlines this week, but with a more somber note. Project Gutenberg founder Michael Stern Hart, regarded as the father of the e-book. He invented the digital version of the library in 1971 by typing the Declaration of Independence into his browser and then sending the link around to his friends. A real pioneer, the humble Hart is responsible for the largest collection of e-books in the world. But Amazon, the world's largest bookseller, has eyes on that prize. They announced this week that they were planning to roll out an extensive book rental scheme in a similar vein as movie rental services Love Film and Netflix. Jemima, what is their plan?
Well, scant details at the moment. And this is one of the Wall Street Journal's infamous reports, according to people familiar with the situation. But Amazon already offers for $79 a year a TV and movie rental service. And the report is that they're going to add ebooks to this, which for them is, you know, digital content is digital content. It doesn't really matter what it is. So that's a logical extension for their business because they can very easily expand their inventory, which they say ebooks are selling more than printed books. I find very hard to fathom. But still, and also it's a logical extension for consumers, I think, because if you understand the concept of downloading and watching a film, then obviously downloading and reading an ebook is not a radical concept to get your head around.
But ultimately, is this an aim to boost their Kindle sales, do you think?
Well, ebooks, supposedly, according to McQuivy research, by the end of 2011 will have a 14% share in the US, which is a significant amount of market share. And I think obviously it's in Amazon's interest to try and put as much content out there as possible. And as we talked about recently with apps, there's an excellent piece by Charles talking about mobile apps on this, but Amazon already has a payment system in place which makes it very easy for people to pay for and download stuff onto their whatever device it is, whereas Google doesn't. And this is the advantage that Amazon has in competing with Apple.
Is there such a model for games? I know there's downloadable content like Steam and you know those types of services, Keith. But for rental, for limited time use, is there such a thing?
Well, the major publishers aren't really going down that route. They're experimenting with different distribution models all the time, especially in the digital space. I mean, I think probably the closest thing to that would be OnLive, which is the cloud gaming service, which is just launched in the UK and launched in the US last year. And they essentially give you access to games remotely via the internet. So you never actually download the game, you play it online. And they have two models there. You can either actually purchase the game to play whenever you want outright, or you can subscribe and it's almost like essentially renting the game for a fixed amount. So that is where that's working at the moment in the cloud space with OnLive. I cannot see the major publishers offering full game rentals via download. They're massive files, and also, you know, it's economies of the scale of the projects and the price. You know, retail games about 60, you know, 70 pounds, whereas a book is cheaper. It's a whole different relationship that they have with their customers. So I can't see that happening. I think the model really is going to be things like OnLive offering rental, but I think the big companies are going to stick with demos and beta tests rather than full products.
Jemima, how will publishers make money out of this kind of relationship?
I think that's what publishers are trying to work out, and there were howls of anguish at this announcement this week. They will make less on ebooks, but they also won't have to front up as much for shipping costs, obviously, because distribution is negligible. But they are also worried about the perceived loss of value, and we, as human beings, can't help but associate a value with a tangible object. And so it'll be interesting to see what the consumer reaction to this is. There is also a little kind of the silver lining in the cloud, I suppose, for authors, is that this is a real opportunity for authors that are a little bit more imaginative and open to, I don't want to say transmedia, but, you know, sort of, sorry.
Say gamify now, go on, say
no!
It.
but if they are authors that are quite public and are very good at engaging with people and talking to people about their work and can come up with some interesting ways of promoting their work in a digital environment, this could be a really, really good time for them.
Well, also in this week's news, there's a new mobile hardware manufacturer trying to get into the operating system business. HTC, the Taiwanese handset maker, announced that they're looking into purchasing some of the existing operating systems that are on the market, WebOS or MeeGo, according to technology news site ZDNet. I don't know, you decide. Jemima, HTC is best known for its relationship with the Google Android platform. Why the change? They seem to be doing pretty well with their existing system.
This was only something that, again, was sort of gently mooted by the chairperson at a conference recently. The relationship with Android has definitely been successful. They did have a relationship with Nokia before this, but HTC has arguably been brought to the world by the relationship with Android. I would suspect that the looming patent battles over Android are an element of this, and HTC is looking to reduce their dependency on Android. They do also do a limited number of Windows Phone 7 phones, but as we know, those don't have an enormous chunk of the market so far. And so it was the chair, Cher Wang, that said that they had discussed this and considered it, but was very far from making any kind of commitment to which direction they'd go in.
Keith, one of the major headaches for games developers on mobile, and we're seeing a whole bunch of people who are now gaming on the go with their smartphones, historically has been, well, there are too many different operating systems to program for. And so people just, you know, they code for Symbian or they code for whatever. Mm-hmm. At the minute, it feels very much as if Android and the iOS, the iPhone's operating system, they kind of had the corner on the gaming market. Is HTC not kind of shooting themselves in the foot? This is a pretty unique selling point for hardware.
I think you're right. I think 5 or 10 years ago, well, 5 years ago, mobile gaming, it was completely stumped by interoperability, lack of interoperability, and also fragmentation of the market. And, you know, Java was the key platform, but it wasn't as interoperable as it should have been. iPhone came along and then Android, and they've created these secure, stable platforms which work the same across handsets, and that has led to mobile gaming flourishing, as we've seen today. Windows Phone 7 has had nowhere like the support from developers so far, even though it's got really nice integration with Xbox Live and it's really cool for gamers. There's just not enough support for it. And if Microsoft can't break into this with a new OS and a quite a nice OS, then I don't see how HTC are gonna make any difference. I think more fragmentation is a bad idea for apps.
And finally, they say a supercomputer predicted Osama bin Laden's whereabouts and the revolutions in the Middle East. I'm skeptical. Predicting future events through network technology isn't just science fiction, though. Google has funded early exploratory analysis of the PAX system, which scours the world's content and produces reports for paying world leaders curious to test the pulse of the global sensibilities. This reeks of data-driven retrospect. Are we in the middle of Minority Report? What's going on here?
Well, Nautilus, the machine in question, surveyed or kind of analysed 100 million news stories. I was wondering if maybe 80 million of those were sort of top 10 lists by Mashable, but determined sort of good and bad the sentiment in those stories and then location of events and people mentioned in them. It just seems such a blunt instrument by which to analyse something as nuanced and delicate as the news. It's sort of hopelessly simplistic, really.
I don't think
we can really seriously take any of the results of this. I noticed that the two events that they, really pick out have already happened. It's like, I don't need a computer to tell me that these things have happened because we know that they've happened.
Do you know if the analysis happened? Well, obviously it happened post hoc, didn't it? Because that's,
yes.
So it happened now. Basically, this is the results of a computer science.
Yes.
A computer science study.
So looking back and saying, look at these news stories, they've predicted what happened in the news stories.
PAX, which I mentioned before, which is the Google-supported system, and Nautilus, these are not the first ones that have come about. People have been trying to predict, what's going on, what will happen.
Well, where this gets really interesting, as is often the case with technology, is if you look at the intelligence services, because if these kind of services, and if services like PAC and projects and experiments like that are being mooted in public, then what is the technology that DARPA, for example, is playing with? Because that really will be predictive. And if it is predictive, then why are we still having wars? Because shouldn't they be able to stop it?
Well, arguably, there's something to do with Minority Report, though. You know, have you seen it, where the wrong person gets tagged with the bad? I mean, there are so many different films and games. You know, the stakes are so high; people are going to die. I mean, it feels like science fiction. Keith, there must be countless games that tackle this subject. What are your top three?
Well, strangely, that there aren't games don't really deal with prediction as that much, because games are essentially about prediction, and they're about putting yourself into those situations. So gamers don't want to have a game where it says this might happen in the future, you've got to stop it, because the games are more about action than prediction. So you get lots of games like Deus Ex Human Revolution, which has just come out, which is all about biomechanical augmentation and cyberpunk mythology. Those sorts of things are kind of much more interesting, work in the game space better, because they are allowing you to interact with worlds that have been predicted by the game designers. And so, yeah, you don't get that many games where it says you're a cop and you've got to predict this happening, because it's too ethereal. Games are about being in that space, not in predicting another space.
Is it going to be like in Star Trek, where kids that grow up in these fantasy worlds now are going to create these fantasy worlds when they're older?
Yes, 100%.
Yeah, definitely.
Absolutely. And that is truly unfortunate, because I think this is a massive gap in the market. There could be there could be some fascinating plots where people just come out of nowhere and try and draw all this stuff in. Well, if you have a favorite game or a favorite film that does this, contradicting what Keith just said.
Yeah, feel free to contradict me.
Please feel free to contradict Keith and send in your favorites to techweekly@guardian.co.uk or tweet us at GuardianTW. And follow all the news as it unravels at guardian.co.uk/technology. MotorStorm Apocalypse and Killzone 3 are a couple of titles that have taken gaming into the third dimension. But how do games developers approach creating a game in 3D? Well, did you know that there's a team actually researching best use of the tech in games? Keith caught up with Ian Bickerstaff from Sony's Stereoscopic 3D team after his recent presentation at the Develop Games conference and asked him about his and his colleague Simon Benson's background in 3D.
Well, it's a funny one, really, because both Simon and myself used to work for British Aerospace, as it was known then, for 15 years in flight simulation. And we looked after the visual systems for Eurofighter. And that's actually when we first got into 3D, because they were doing more and more complicated simulations with lots of things going on. And they needed to visualize what was going on in the simulator in real time and present that information to generals and decision makers in a concise, clear way. And we originally created a thing called it was called a 3D table, and it was a table, and it was 3D, and it was horizontal, but the images were sort of anamorphically distorted to look correct when you view it from the side rather than straight on, and it created that sort of amazing Princess Leia type of technique, you know, the 3D that sort of really, it's that sort of effect. In fact, we won an award for it even. This is back in 1997, 98, something like that. We suddenly realised the potential of high-quality 3D at that time. And, I mean, people talk about 3D being a fad, but it's interesting that I still keep in touch with my colleagues at BAE Systems, as they're now known, and it's part of everyday life for them. It's just a routine engineering tool for them.
So what do game developers have to do to use 3D well? What are the important parts of using 3D so that it's more than just, whoa, something's thrown out of the screen at me?
I think that the key thing is to preserve the roundness of the image. 3D is all about taking the full range of depth in your real or virtual world and compressing it into a range that's comfortable to view on the TV screen. And a naive way of doing that is to compress all the depth, and you end up with everything looking like a cardboard cutout, which is not very good. So the trick is to preserve the roundness of the objects. And there are lots of different techniques that we can use to do that. And that's the clever bit, really, you know, and that's how to get good 3D.
Okay. What we've obviously noticed from the first generation of new 3D movies and games is there is a lot of this sense that 3D is a visual thing, and that it's all about surprising the audience by making things come out of the screen at them. But can there be an emotional angle to 3D as well? Can it heighten the emotional experience of watching a playing a game?
The main difference between 2D and 3D, and this seems a little bit obvious really, is that with 2D, we make assumptions about the scale of the world. We use perspective cues. We use our knowledge of the world to try to understand the size of objects. But with 3D, you precisely define the scale of an object, and you can create emotional responses by adjusting that effect. So, for instance, in the presentation, I show an image of a life-size great white shark taken from 9 meters away, and it looks like a goldfish. And that is simply because the cameras are 10 times further apart than our eyes would be. And we've scaled the shark down into a completely non-threatening object. So go the other way around, and then we show the shark life-size, and of course it's an incredibly scary-looking object. It's a shark. And you could go even further, make the shark even bigger if you want to, and you can just play with that. You can imagine you could use that. If you want to create a sense of confinement, then you show a world, and you show it just a little bit smaller than it should be. And it might not be anything that anyone would register when they're looking at the image directly, but it's sort of there in their subconscious that it's a bit more confined than maybe they would like, and it can create a sense of unease and so on.
What's the next phase of this technology? I was talking to one of your colleagues at Sony yesterday, and he was saying, well, we're nowhere near really glasses free 3D at the moment on a big television, because you have to sit in one exact position. But what do you think is going to be the next thing that might help drive 3D more towards a lot of cynical people who still think it's a fad?
Well, going into corporate marketing mode for a moment, I suppose I should mention our new PlayStation 3D monitor. Normally with split screen, you have to have an image that's half the normal size. Well, you can imagine 3D is all about creating two images. Well, maybe in a multiplayer environment, what if we had two-dimensional images of the game? So player one sees one image, player two sees another image. And it's just about remoding the glasses. It's very easy for us to do that.
So it's split-screen gaming, but you don't have the inconvenience of having the screen split down the middle. You just wear different glasses and you both see different versions of the same game.
Absolutely. Another one is the head-mounted display, which, as far as I know, is still very much a prototype. Whether it will go into production, I don't know. We've got one in our office.
Do you wear it like glasses and it's got two OLED screens that...
Yeah, it's sort of a bit like the old virtual reality headsets, where you have the OLED screens, then an optical arrangement that presents the image as if it was a very large screen. It's like a cinema experience sort of in your head, really. It's also got surround sound and things like that as well.
Does it have head tracking?
Ah, head tracking. Yes, in the sense that someone sellotaped a Move controller to the prototype, and it works surprisingly well. But in the longer term, yes, it's quite likely that those sort of features will be included.
Is that where you see this technology going, towards the virtual reality, towards the holodeck? Or
holodecks would be great, wouldn't they? It's certainly something that interests me. And it's something that's standard in industry, particularly engineering, car design, and so on. They use this sort of technique. And, just as you could imagine, it's brilliant to be able to have a life-size replica of a new prototype car in a design studio, and the designer can walk around it as if it's actually there. oh, how good would that be in a game, you know? Why not take the same sort of technology, present it in your living room?
So the future could be, say, a Resident Evil game where a zombie appears to climb out of your television and the television 3D display knows where you are, it can track your head so you'll be able to walk around that zombie.
I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned climb out of the screen, because most people completely ignore the edge of the screen when they create images. They sort of pretend it's not there. And yet, you know, why not make the screen a collision object in your game? So objects bounce off the edges of your television, you know. And suddenly, if you present that sort of trick, you'll end up with the virtual world appearing to be a complete seamless transition into your living room. And, you know, it's going to be quite exciting, I think, in the future, doing this sort of stuff.
Ian Bickerstaff from Sony. So, Keith, Ian was very positive about 3D. You've said that he's really passionate about this subject, but is it a fad? And I suppose we could even ask Mark Kermode this, the film yeah. reviewer. Is it a fad? Are we just experiencing gaming's William Castle moment?
I don't think so, because I think it spreads so far down the pipeline of home entertainment. I think that there's a statistic at the moment that by 2014, half of all TVs that are produced will have 3D capabilities. A report by a Display Search, an analyst in this area, said that there'll be 100 million 3D TVs sold by 2014.
Why?
Because it's so cheap. It costs $25 to put the technology into a TV. So it's going to be like Freeview. You know, like for a little while, Freeview was only in a few TVs. Then suddenly it's so cheap to put in. Let's put it in.
They're not going to sell those TVs for 25 quid more, though, are they? They're going to be substantially more than that.
Not coming up. It's just going to be absorbed into the price. So it's going to be there. I think in the next 5 years, we're going to see a move away from stereoscopic 3D, which requires glasses, to auto-stereoscopic 3Ds. This is something that Mick Hocking, who also works on 3D at Sony, he did a talk. Well, he was part of a panel discussion at Gamescom, the big European Games Festival, last month. And he was saying within 10 years, he sees auto-stereoscopic televisions in the front room. So basically you will get a 3D experience without having to wear glasses. The images will just be viewable from any space in your living room.
Help me, only Obi-Wan, you're my only hope.
Exactly. Well, that's it. And he also said that the future is going to be holographics in the living room. So we will have in our living room a holographic imaging machine. That sounds very Victorian.
R2D2.
It's going to be run by steam.
Steam powered. Holographics in the living room are, you know, he said will be a reality in 10 years as well. So we're going to get to the point maybe where we watch 3D without any sort of glasses or anything like that. And that's where it will become a much more interesting proposition to people. And that's when maybe Mark Kermode's going to have to maybe admit that he's wrong. I don't know. I'm an apologist for technology. I appreciate that. There have been problems with 3D, though. Nintendo 3DS obviously hasn't done quite as well as Nintendo had hoped. It was launched to great fanfare. Didn't have that many great games. A lot of people weren't satisfied with the auto-stereoscopic technology on that machine. It's quite dated technology. A minority of people were becoming ill because there was a lot of crosstalk on the display. Lots of people haven't had that problem at all. Nintendo have tried to bolster it by reducing the price, and they've just last Tuesday have announced lots of new games for it. They've done that awful thing where they thought, let's try and make it appeal to more women, so they're bringing out a pink version.
Oh, and
obviously.
Pink, fuck
brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
I thought that would go down well.
Yeah. All of this is great. We are effectively laying the foundations for something that will become normal, that will become kind of standard and normalized. And then in 10, 15 years time, when we've got over the fact that, you know, that we had in movies that, you know, some monster runs out at the screen and everybody screams and throws their popcorn in the air, or, you know, somebody points a BFG at me and I think it's real.
What
and then
is
run
wrong
it.
With the BFG? I think we need
it's
to
not,
address this.
It's out. Not the BFG. It's a BFG, which is a type of gun, a big gun.
Oh, that was me thinking you were having a Roald Dahl moment.
No,
I was like, I love the BFG.
Even though we are recording on Roald Dahl Day, it's a different kind of BFG. Okay. But all of that is going to pass, and we will have a kind of normalized
fine, 3D is happening. You know, I can hug my virtual mother in my living room, you know, through holograms. That's absolutely brilliant. Are there any examples out there of 3D now, of gaming 3D, that we could actually interact with that foretell this amazing future? Or is this all just theoretical?
Well, there's a couple of games that are using 3D very nicely. Uncharted 3 is coming out this Christmas, and that uses stereoscopic 3D in a really nice way. Uncharted is named for its very, very lavish scenes and sets, and those come across really nicely in 3D. There's also been a couple of augmented reality games which use 3D in quite an interesting way by placing objects within your game world. So it uses the either the PlayStation or the Kinect camera to film your surroundings, and then those are used in the 3D images on screen.
Where does Sony see the future of 3D if it's not with the technologies that, you know, that we use right now?
I know for a fact that Sony are experimenting with holographic technology. We also heard Ian there talking about virtual reality headsets again. Sony will be working on a number of different scenarios based around 3D because they are very heavily invested in getting us to use this, because it drives software sales, it drives hardware sales. They make the movie cameras, you know, if they make 3D movies, Sony are involved in that as well. So they're very heavily invested in this. So I think for Sony, the future, I think, could either go towards virtual reality headsets or holographic displays, and maybe even a mixture of both. Biometrics, which is this idea of technology being able to read what the player is thinking and feeling and emoting while they're playing.
I wouldn't say thinking. Please don't say thinking.
Maybe not thinking just yet, but although there are obviously games controllers being developed at the moment which can read thought, brain waves. He envisaged a time, I think, maybe in 10 years, where a 3D display with a camera will be able to watch what the player is thinking and how they react. So if you take like a horror game, it could be that a player is playing and a certain horrifying image appears on the screen, like a zombie. If the camera on the console picks up a very overt emotional response to that particular monster, well, the next time it comes on screen, it could be coming out at you in 3D, because they want to basically manipulate our emotional response.
Yes, they
do.
So they want me to go under the duvet and hide in the corner quivering.
Exactly, they do. So they will use any tool they can to do that. 3D is brilliant at reading your personal space, and biometrics are brilliant for reading your emotions. And with those,
do they input targeted advertising tied into all of that? The world gets quite terrifying.
It certainly does.
Well, I mean, one thing that is happening though on that side is that advertisers that create 3D displays for advertising are using autostereoscopic displays. I was in Santa Monica last week, and there was advertising hoardings which had 3D autostereoscopic displays. So trailers of 3D films were sort of coming out at me as I was walking past. As that technology becomes cheaper, I very much suspect that we're going to start seeing that in shops, and that will obviously be tied in with shopper data as well that they've got from loyalty cards. So that Minority Report thing of you know, you walking through Gap and saying, Alex, try these trousers on.
Honestly, it'll be like, what in God's earth are you wearing?
Yeah, get out of our shop.
Please wear this. Just do something. Honestly, I run away from the fashion editors in The Guardian, just in case they pierce me with their blazing eyes.
Yeah, I'd go down that corridor. Yeah.
But all credit to the games industry for sure for consistently and persistently innovating in the face of skeptics like me. You can read more gaming news and find out all the information at guardian.co.uk/games. That's all for this week's podcast. You can see all the links from this program at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Thank you very much to our studio guests, Keith Stewart and Jemima Kish. Jemima.
Yes.
This is your last week with us for a while, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm working on my own incubator project, or I'm working on Jemima 3.0. You know, add tech analogy here. But
you're
yes.
Giving birth.
Yeah, I'm going off to spawn again.
Incredible. Well, that's yes. That's pretty fast. You've just decided and you're going. No,
to say that the bump. Instantaneous. No, the bump has been growing, not quite as rapidly as last time, but But yes, I don't know when I'll be back, sometime next year. Depends how much of a zombie I am, but I'll still be on Twitter, no doubt.
Well, I'm sure we will come out and we will find you.
Contractions, a minute apart.
But we will find you next year and drag you back kicking and screaming to the studio.
Oh, yeah.
Will you be testing any of the apps that you can use for contraction timing? There's actual apps.
I found a brilliant breastfeeding one last time, so yeah, probably.
God help me, I wish I'd not bought this up.
It's fine. Hopefully your dirty mind will have suffused and diffused by that point, but we look forward to having you back. Enjoy your time away. Producer Scott Colley and I will return next Tuesday, however, with another two folks in tow, including Chief Scientist at Salesforce, J.P. Ragaswamy, and Charles Arthur. Join us then. I'm Alex Kratosky. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.